Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 78, where Pedro, Catherine, Tom, and Sam are discussing Alvin Guldner's book, Patterns of Industrial Bureaucracy, a case study of modern factory administration, originally published by the Free Press, New York, in 1954. If you missed part one, you can access it on our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
We started by saying that this book is truly a classic, right? And some people say that the way through which we understand a classic is that when we read it, we have the impression we already read it before. You know, just think of Hamlet. You may not have not read it yourself, but everyone knows the famous to be or not to be. And I think this book is a little bit like that. We talked about on how Alvin Guldner's part of the Columbia School, and this book is part of this effort to ground the understanding of organizations on this more empirical fieldwork type of approach, right? But ever since, organizational scholarship has blossomed and created all sorts of paths. And interestingly, I think the book has been central to the development of many theories and perspectives, right? It's very important for discussions about compliance. It's very important for people that study rules, of course. It's important for people that study organizational forms beyond bureaucracy, but also those who have studied bureaucracy, such as the work of Paul Adler, who has taken some of the ideas of Guldner and examined them deeper and came up with the distinction between coercive and enabling bureaucracies, right? It has cast a long shadow, so to speak, in a number of conversations. So I think it would be interesting if we try to tease some of this, right? Some of the paths and topics that the book still speaks to today.
Yeah, maybe you can give us a little bit more about, the comparison with the work at Tavistock.
I was setting up someone else who don't talk now. So maybe Sam or Catherine, you know, you wanted to...
For me, there's one element to this that stood out for me, and that was really the importance of culture in the context of, you know, introducing change or change management. Like, you could actually read this book completely as a case study in how change management goes wrong, basically. It could be read that way, you know, and the perils of instituting change and using bureaucracy, you know, and the unintended consequences that are rarely satisfactory for everybody and all of that. So I think, you know, that is a big element of this. And how important in change management, and lots of different people have lots of different models and frameworks for this, but recognizing that there needs to be an acknowledgement of the culture that exists when you impose any type of bureaucracy or any type of rules or change on an organization. And in this instance, you know, that culture was this indulgency culture and this indulgency pattern, which was very ingrained in the workplace, in the organization, but not necessarily negatively. You know, there was lots of positive elements to the indulgency pattern, and the word indulgent sounds so negative in its connotations. But, you know, using the sample room as a hospital, well, there's elements of that that are actually quite humane, to give workers a break, you know, at a time when there wasn't probably much care for their welfare. I don't know how much vacation annual leave that people got, but they must have been exhausted. The work was tiring. The fact that people looked out for each other and they had those social ties and connections and those norms that established because of it created a place where people felt arguably safe in what was often physically a very unsafe environment to do their best work. You know, there was this imposition of the bureaucratic rules as a tool of change management, exactly really is how I saw it, to try and institute change. When Peel came in, he was under huge pressure from his superiors, and he needed to institute change. And all he had open to him, because he had no social ties, he had no social capital built up, and he didn't really try very hard to build it up either. He just felt under pressure to produce results. And all he had left to him was this imposition of rules, which of course failed. He tried different techniques as well, like co-optation, by recruiting people in who would basically follow his route. I think it was Digger was the guy's name, who's the head of HR that he brought in to try and do his work. He tried close supervision as well. And I love that description in the book. You know, we were talking about how readable this book is, about Peel popping up like a mouse in a hole. You know, I thought that was a great, great description of how you can see him popping up across the factory, you know, getting in the way, watching people closely. You know, this is going to alienate people even more. You know, it's being set up to fail. The lieutenants, he lost his kind of chain of command. They didn't have any belief in him. I think Tom very well described earlier on this kind of Rebecca syndrome, as it's called, you know, where everybody thinks that what went before was so much better and so much rosier as well. And he didn't obviously give any thought to what the culture and the environment was. For me, the book reminds us that culture permeates and mediates the meaning of all technical phenomena, including bureaucratic rules. And it highlights the importance of the physical world in that as well. That chapter 3 about the difference and how illuminated the mine in particular is, you know, you feel that you're almost there. You can almost smell the gypsum, right? It's really evocative and vivid and very well described and very, very enjoyable to read. But how important that culture is in any change management initiatives, and how, you know, it is the rock on which you can perish if you don't address it or acknowledge it at least, and think about what tools you're using in those settings.
But you also got to be very careful about using culture as a tool of bureaucracy as well.
Absolutely. And it often is.
You know, we're kind of outside of Goulder now. We're revisiting the episode we did before on Gideon Kunda. It's very easy for these sorts of books to take away the wrong lessons and to try something else different without considering the possible consequences. And there you have it. So tech culture, the mandated culture, essentially is the suite of bureaucratic rules that dictate behavior, dictate one's loyalty to the organization, dictate what symbols and what artifacts and what other things are important to a member of an organization. And naturally, ultimately drove some significant broken people, broken behaviors, a very unhealthy, toxic situation. You're absolutely right. Culture is a very, very important part, or a very important consideration. We also have to be very careful not to use it as a tool for its own purposes, or like it is not the end all to be all. You don't solve or make change happen by force feeding a culture any more than you make change happen by force feeding rules. There's so many things that have to be considered. The sin, just as you had indicated, was the lack of worker involvement directly. You wonder to what extent would the workforce have accepted Peel a little bit better if Peel was able to buy himself just a little more time and to be able to engage. One of the things I really was taken aback by in the book was the fact that the leadership did not spend time in the mine. They might as well have been on the other, you know, another continent. The psychosocial separation, I think, of the mine versus the surface, where the surface was all hands-on and bureaucratized to heck, and the mine was something else, is bothersome. And it should give us pause. Like getting back to what we were talking about, leadership has got to think about how to make all of the organization in some way inclusive, despite the difference in context. That, I think, was an indicative of a failing, and hopefully, you know, people could take away from this particular example of just how bad that is.
So I listening to that, and I was thinking, why is that so, right? And I think part of it is that many tools have become available and have been becoming taken for granted for management. And exactly, culture has been understood eventually as a tool. But I think that the interesting theoretical lesson here is first that in your discussion and in the book, I think we learn how much there is symbolism to what is the formal hardwiring type of thing, right? A rule or a procedure or whatever, right? Even the hierarchy. But at the same time, you know, and thinking about Kunda, we see how symbols can be regulated and formalized and have this also this more like tangible aspect as well. Like, so this interplay, I think, is what Goldner has certainly helped to show. And, you know, we recently had the episode on Selznick, and his whole point was exactly that some kind of administrative structure systems, they sometimes take a life of their own, so to speak, because they are institutionalized with meaning beyond their technical value, right? So it's again, you can see how it is also, this insight is emerging here as well. I mean, no wonder that, you know, Selznick and Goldner were affiliated to have the same mentor and were in the same point in time writing these things. But what I was thinking also in terms of what happened ever since, I think it's at least two things, right? In terms of the conflict that this bureaucratization and the arrival of Peel brought, well, ever since, a lot of tools to pacify workers from holidays, as you're referring to, Catherine, right? To, you know, all type of welfare benefits that are taken for granted have been put to play in order to give back some of the indulgency that was described here, like in a piecemeal regulated way. And at the same time, I think ever since, management has expanded to pay attention not just to the hardwiring, right? So creating a rule, but also trying to manipulate, mold the symbols in which the rules are understood, right? Which you're referring to. And even more in referring to what Tom was saying, also trying to be part of the social ties of people, right? To integrate itself in a certain way and maybe not necessarily deconstruct or tease out or break down the ties that existed, but also to try to manipulate the ways in which people interact, manipulate who is talking to whom, manipulate the way people, you know, who are the peers that you put together and so on and so forth, right? So I think that the book reveals what was common then and, you know, ever since we have, since the explosion of different ways through which control is achieved.
Well, what I wonder is now 70 years later, you know, hearing what you're saying, I also wonder if perhaps, you know, in the modern workforce, I definitely don't know the answer to this, but in the modern workforce, have they become so attenuated to these attempts at manipulation that it's bred a certain amount of cynicism or a certain amount of inherent resistance, almost like an instinctive resistance against anything that management attempts to do to try to change culture? I can come up with examples of both, you know, where perhaps yes, perhaps no. I don't know. But what do y'all think?
I think it matters to what extent, like, the changes or the, you know, the culture or the rules that management is trying to implement connects also to people's interest or reasons for being there. I think something that is mentioned in passing in the book, and I don't think we've, like, talked about directly, even though like what Catherine was saying kind of links to that, is that what Goldner says about miners basically were working for the money that would allow them to have pleasure, whereas the people working in the surface, in the offices, were working towards security. So I think that if you think about the bureaucratic rules being introduced, they probably gave a sense of security and a clear way of telling workers, you know, if you follow these rules, then you'll have your job, you will do well, you can be promoted. Whereas these rules, to some extent, kind of clashed in the mine with this culture, this interest that that miners had of kind of enjoying what they do and working and, yes, putting their lives at risk, but also having a benefit that would allow them to do things that give them pleasure. So I think this is important too.
I wonder as well, and I don't want to keep talking about culture, but just thinking about, you know, whether an organization is the culture, or has the culture, is it an argument for the fact that the culture is what it is, and trying to impose a culture using culture as a tool is unlikely to succeed?
I was going to say the short answer, if we think with Goldner's caps, is that, well, what are the patterns? It can be the culture of the manager imposed on the employees and how it's happening, right? And I think Kunda's book is interesting because, in a way, the culture is shared, but it's trying, it's used and it's wielded in a way to achieve certain things, but it is shared between managers and employees, right? But it could be different, such as in the case of an industrial organization like the one that Goldner studied.
I would also add that, to answer your question, Catherine, you know, the perspective or the frame that the leadership is using, you know, like we talk about an organization that is very, very diverse in terms of its culture. Like, you can't really, can you really say that the organization has a single culture? Probably not. There's three. There's the management, there's the mine, and there's the surface. And a lot of organizations have these subcultures that are so distinct in the way that they look at things, whether it's the task, the geography of where they're located, if they're physically separate or what have you. And so then sometimes, you know, in the guise of trying to get everybody unified, you know, trying to get them to think of themselves as part of a whole organization rather than their subculture, culture as a tool to do that could be very, very easily unsuccessful if it just comes across as this is management trying to impose itself upon us. There's a question as to, well, all right, if you have a need in order to find some sort of shared value that needs to be reinforced that affects everybody equally, then okay, you know, maybe you could develop rules or whatever that would help with that. But to the extent that they don't impinge upon the separate subordinate or the subculture identity, that would provoke a negative reaction. You know, leaders in large, I guess, diverse organization, I'll call it a diverse organization, that's a tremendous challenge because of the pressures that leaders ordinarily feel to do something, you know, if they think that there's something wrong with the organization.
I do not have a response to that, but I was going to go somewhere else. Can
I? Yeah, let's leave culture behind.
So listening to that in part, I am reflecting on, I think, something that Sam brought before, which is the extent that work matters and the extent that the type of work can also breed these different cultures, at least these different understandings. And also, let's bring a level down of abstraction, the particular ways in which people understand their task and so on and so forth and value and blah, 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 right? Which is exactly the insight that a lot of workplace ethnographers from Steve Barley, Beth Patrick, and many, and Rothan Hughes, and many others have shown exactly, right? The importance of looking at the occupational communities. And also, it's interesting to see that there are already the seeds in the book here. But I think what is a bit counterintuitive in terms of what's happened ever since the book was published is that the mine, so to speak, has been heavily bureaucratized, right? It was first industrialized, and with this industrialization came a more bureaucratic way of organizing. And that's exactly the topic of one of our other podcasts, the ones in which we talk about the Tris and Banthorpe's paper, in which they describe, the Tavistock authors that describe the way in which the change from a hand-getting type of mining to a more one that's called long wall, which is basically this industrialized one that you proceed by batches, and you know, you have people that are divided in a very specialized way, and the production can be continuous. So it's not just based in this kind of self-governing teams and putting and progressing at their own pace, but it is, you know, at an industrialized scale. That has happened, right? And I think it's interesting to see what Goldner describes as kind of, you know, unthinkable. Of course, technology can think. Technology can sweep in and change the way the work is organized, and that has downstream impact in all sorts of things, right? Because what that paper documented is that once the work became industrialized / bureaucratized and people work in a more individualized way, there was a lot of absenteeism skyrocketed. Motivation went down substantially, right? And that's when the Tavistock author is trying to come of ways in which you can reinstitute social ties, reinstitute the sense of autonomy, and so on and so forth. So it's interesting to see a distinction, right, which what happened ever since, and at the same time, how some of the elements were reconstructed because they were come to be understood as important in allowing for the work to be done, but also for the people to have the motivation, the eagerness, and the sense that they are pursuing a worthy task.
Yes, and I think another factor that is related to, you know, the type of task or the type of work that they're performing is this idea of danger or risk, right? Which is very present. I mean, this is a beautiful case because you can clear, even if you know, don't know much about these sorts of plans, you can very easily understand why miners would have this kind of constant sense of danger or of risk, whereas maybe office workers do not have it. And I think it's really interesting. I mean, even for, you know, when I think about my own work as well, even if it's all office work, but when there's risk of outside events or people or actors threatening the success of the work that you're doing, then you tend to depart a little bit more from these bureaucratic rules, right? Like you need to rely on people's expertise, informal networks, or other types of skills that can protect the work in case of an expected situation. So I think this is very interesting as well, even when we're reflecting about, you know, bureaucracy and bureaucracy as an answer to problems. You know, what's the kind of limits of how bureaucratic rules can help us achieve good work when you have a very unstable or uncertain environment?
And also, well, the workaround. I mean, how many of us have been in bureaucracies where, you know, the rules are wonderful things, but there's always those exception cases, or there's always that, that, you know, it's not just about personal risk. It's also about trying to help somebody through where the bureaucracy just, the, you know, I'm talking about bureaucracy as a thing as opposed to a phenomenon, but the bureaucracy says no. And the ability to work through or to come up with those workarounds or to be able to work the rules or to, you know, the challenge, I think, is that when these rules get imposed, if they get imposed a little bit too stringently, and it's not even necessary, I think it's almost independent of the pattern. If they're inflexible or if they're not adaptable to the situation, then they introduce inefficiencies on their own. And sometimes it's hard to tell when that is. I mean, how do you really know whether or not a set of bureaucratic rules is truly efficient or is actually getting in the way of what it's supposed to be doing? Because that happens over time, I think. You know, the rule that was established this year, 2 years later, may very well not make sense. But it's not always apparent when that tipping point occurs and the rule is lost its purpose or is deviated from its purpose. Yeah, go ahead.
So literature has an answer to that, right? And that I think is interesting if you think of what else came after Goldner, Crozier, and I think Blau, another from the Columbia School, and later Wadsler. They all point to the importance of change. So in exactly what you're talking about, the ability of the bureaucracy to correct itself. And Crozier says that the dysfunctional bureaucracy is exactly one in which it is not and is not able to do that. And Blau later talks about how this dynamism, and he talks about other elements as well that are important to allow for some kind of, you know, a more effective bureaucracy to persevere in time. And the ability to change is one of them. And Poaldre's work, which is based in part on lean, which is an interesting thing, right? Because lean production system is by definition very formal. It's not that there are less rules than there are in Taylorism, but there is ownership by the workers, which are incentivized to, you know, bring their capacity to think and change them, right? So that's, I think, the important thing, going back to the work, going back to all these things. So the extent in which the rules can be changed, the extent to which people have a say, the extent in which the people doing the work itself have a say in how it should be formalized is an important aspect factor in the extent, you know, you will end up with a very dysfunctional bureaucracy that people are just like working around it, or one in which it is reflecting what is the goal and the tasks that are supposed to be achieved.
I think Goldner, I mean, you went to the, you know, people that came after Goldner, but I think he provides an answer in the book itself. I mean, for me, that's what mock bureaucracy is about. It's about rules that don't make sense, that don't have a immediate kind of function or yeah, they're not useful or not perceived as useful or important immediately by the people that are doing it. And so they kind of leave it there, right? And it's kind of a symbolic thing. It's a, right? Like, it makes me think about inhabited institutionalism. And I mean, they've gone really into looking at that point, but it makes me then think about what's the function in organizations about having this kind of mock bureaucracy around certain tasks or certain rules. And I think what I liked from reading what Goldner says about mock bureaucracy is how I feel that it's one of those instances where it brings people together, or it brings different groups together, you know, in this acknowledgement that, okay, this rule is here, but we don't need to respect it. And, you know, I won't tell if you don't tell, in a way. And I think, I don't know, I like it. I think it brings people together in a different way than that representative bureaucracy does.
The challenge, though, is that sometimes that, you know, we intentionally build those sorts of rules precisely so that, you know, it's a form of resistance. It's a form of, we look at it as something where higher headquarters is trying to protect themselves from scrutiny. So as long as the rule is on the books, then we've served a purpose. It's immensely frustrating because there's probably no faster way to build cynicism and provoke worker resistance against the idea of bureaucratic rules than to be dealing with rules that have no real purpose. I mean, we should be getting away, much more away from that. It's like, you know, the best sounding answer or the most attractive answer is right there in the book, participative. But it seems to be the one that we seem to pursue the least often because it's hard. I would venture to say that it's so much easier to just craft a rule and say, we're going to fix something, or we're going to fix you, you being whichever worker is being targeted at the moment. And that's it. Be done with it. Bureaucracy done bureaucratically efficient. So the question in my mind becomes, how do we, if participative really is the unstated aim or the preference, or the way that we think that bureaucracy should be done, how do we actually do it? Who's doing it right? I don't really know.
I think, I don't know, Pedro might like this answer. I don't know if he agrees with me, but I think that's, for me, that's where the role of like expert knowledge like becomes important. That's what came through to me when I was reading about, you know, the case that he presents to describe representative bureaucracy, which is the safety rules. In this situation, you need to take into account the people that face these dangers and that have accumulated experience or technical knowledge about these threats and how to handle them, right? So as manager, you don't know everything. And I think that's kind of what happens, I mean, in a slightly different way, and also in Crozier's book, right? It's the people that have this knowledge that can, it's in these situations where people have knowledge or particular knowledge that the other group doesn't have, usually management, that you have to negotiate. So that's, I think that's when it becomes easier to have these representative bureaucracy.
I'll say something and then I expand it a little bit. So Goldner starts with the tension, which comes, I think, all the way back from Parsons or Merchant, saying that traditionally we think of bureaucracy as control on the basis of expertise, right? The assumption being that people in top positions in the hierarchy, they also have more expert about the work under it. But as work becomes more complex, as organizations have multiple errors, become hard for the people at the top to really understand what is going on in situ, right? The kind of challenge people have. And then exactly what Samantha is saying, these complicated relationships come into play, and the extent that the knowledge people have that do the work is listened to or not, then can lead to this more dysfunctional, less functional. You know, again, the case of Lean. If you trust the people that are on the ground and you take into account their suggestions of how the assembly line should be structured, right? So then you may have more buy-in, you may have people that really trust the norms, you might have these more healthy formalizations, the healthy bureaucratization. If not, you may end up in a loop of coercion. But what I wanted to say is that I never thought of this representative as only or necessarily about participation. I usually thought about it as more in, I mean, as also in terms that stand, people understand the goal for which the rule exists, right? Which I think is one of the discussions about green tape versus red tape in public administration. So again, this to some extent can be traced back all the way here, which is the extent people see, oh, there's a purpose for that rule, right? I understand it. They might, you know, be more willing to relate to it in a different way.
No, I definitely appreciate that. Indeed, you know, there is sort of somewhat of an implication that in some way, in order for both sides to agree to the rule, you assume a certain amount of participation. But you're right, that it may not actually exist. It just may be that, you know, everybody just simultaneously comes to the conclusion that this is something that's really, really good. And in some cases, if it's maybe it's a temporary thing, like it's good for the current situation, if it's something that is that generates a shared understanding in crisis, then, you know, hopefully when the crisis is over, the rule goes away or something to that nature. But I also like, Sam, what you brought up about knowledge, because it sort of talks to me about a different way, you know, different ways in which, say, managers can find themselves in the shoes of Vincent Peale, which is to say, in a position of insecurity. And sometimes I wonder if the imposition of rules doesn't come about precisely because of the leader's, you know, feeling insecure or a position of disadvantage And the reaction or the habit of the individual is to fear the exposure of that insecurity. So in the case of Peel, now Peel had the essentially the benefit of an external mandate, which can certainly, you know, embolden somebody to just go ahead and plow through the way things were going. But other cases where you bring in, say, a manager who has, you know, who's brought in because they're very good at management, but not at all familiar with what the organization is, but they don't have either the fortitude or the ability to relate to those who have more knowledge than them. Formalization, that doesn't sound like a particularly good approach to try to formalize, but it becomes the way they do it, and they try to bolster it with a little bit of hubris in order to make it sound like they know what they're doing. That's definitely the wrong way to go about it, but unfortunately we do see it on occasion.
It's also brought to mind for me what you're saying, Tom, was the episode on Dan Brass's paper that we did on power and influence and about formal power versus informal power. And I think, again, you know, that can be read with that lens about, you see, the formal power of the office of CEO, which is essentially Vincent Peel's job, and then the informal power in the people that essentially work for him, and how much they influence what can happen and what can't happen, regardless of the bureaucratic rules, actually. But the conclusion to the Brass paper, if I remember correctly, is that at the end of the day, the power of the office, the formal power, actually trumps everything else. So I'm even more intrigued to read Wildcat Strikes. I think I know what the answer might be to that.
I guess we're going to have to put Wildcat Strike on the list for a future episode. We've referenced it about a dozen times already.
I'm going to have to read it. I'd imagine it's shorter than this, and it's not even that long.
Well, I guess we're coming close to the end of time. We've covered quite a lot of ground. Do we have what do we have as our final thoughts or takeaways about the book?
For me, the main takeaway is, and especially as somebody that's interested in studying bureaucracies, but with this exact approach, right, of studying and understanding real bureaucracies as opposed to ideal types. For me, the big takeaway is to understand how bureaucracy is enacted by considering people's interests, fears, the nature of the work they do, the situations that they encounter, and then understand how bureaucracy is kind of negotiated and enacted, considering all those things. So kind of humanizing bureaucracy.
For me, I really enjoy the book. You know, to anybody listening to this, it's extremely readable. It's very well written. It's entirely accessible to anybody, and it's really enjoyable. After listening to my colleagues on the Selznick podcast before, as I was reading this book, I realized I definitely drew the long straw rather than the short straw by being on this episode. There was a number of elements that I really enjoyed in it. I thought the indulgency pattern was extremely well put together. It was so well observed and so illuminating as well. It's an excellent case study also, I think, in how bureaucracy can be used as a tool of change management and the unintended consequences from using it in that way. Seeing the different levels of bureaucracy from the mock, the representative and the punishment centres. As Tom said, he uses it himself, or he's thinking about using it himself as a tool across the areas that he works in as well. So it's very useful and practical book as well as theoretical. And it calls on us to ask ourselves some deep questions about bureaucracy, really, and its process and its role in our working lives. Does process set us free or not, as the case may be? And also, for me, it's a book about culture and even, you know, the subcultures within organizations, which I think Tom talked about the subcultures as well, which I think is really interesting, and how they can influence how bureaucratization is received, implemented and adhered to as well. And this is really illuminated so vividly in the mine and the surface. Research that was undertaken was excellent. And I don't know, we didn't refer to it, but there is actually a really interesting chapter on how they went about the research in the appendix. Goldner, who was a character unto himself, his personality is really illuminated in that as well. He was a very quirky person. I don't know if I've got time to talk a little bit about Goldner himself, his personality, but he was pretty much reviled when he died in 1980. He was pretty ostracized from his community, including the Columbia School. He died in Madrid and he was on a European lecture tour. And it was in the Telos Journal. There was an obituary by a guy called John Ault talking about the fact that not one person from his Department of Sociology attended his funeral. which is quite sad. But I think, you know, he's wrote an amazing book, an accessible book, a book like all of these classics that we read, generally completely applicable. It's also a book about power, influence, and social capital as well.
I'm glad you brought up that, you know, how we could use this as a tool, you know, especially when we try to reverse engineer. You know, a lot of ways when we're doing change management, we're trying to reverse engineer what happened, what got us to this particular point. Quite often, the results of the bureaucratic rules that we develop or that were developed before differ from what was intended. And whether that's a factor of the poor definition of the rule in the begin with, or just the changing of circumstances over time, or other things, leadership, changes of leadership, changes of personality, you wind up looking at the rules and you say, why are we doing this? Where did this come from? Who came up with this idea in the first place? Well, you know, there's always an answer, and sometimes an indication of, you know, which rules or which circumstances, which context becomes the most important to what you're trying to do as a change agent. This may be a good filtering tool. If you think that the organization is trying to pride itself as one that is participative, or one that involves the all echelons and all voices equally within the organization, and you're finding rules that have a different effect and appear to be so imbued that nobody challenges it or whatever, you've got a flag. If you're in an organization that where the rules are not taken seriously, but the rules are meant to be taken seriously, such as one where safety is a priority or other things, and yet it behaves like a mock bureaucracy because the cynicism or the involvement of the workers is just not there. Well, now we've got a way of asking those questions. Where's the disconnect between what the bureaucracy is supposed to do for the organization and what it's actually doing? Which therefore, hopefully, leads us down a better path of trying to fix it.
So my takeaway is, I think, reflective of what all you said, right? And I think that for me, this is a book that tries to think of bureaucracy from a work point of view. Right, from the doing, from the social context, to try to bring this, which arguably is the historically go-to form through which we have organized, from the pyramids to the space race, to a human scale. Because humans have this interesting tendency to externalize and naturalize what is our own collective construction, right? And the book tries to illuminate that. That bureaucracy is not external to humans. It's not necessarily what one person is doing, but is a product of collective, coordinated human effort. As a human creation, it is also enmeshed in coercion, conflict, exploitation, in all these kinds of things. But it's also potentially a tool. It offers potentiality for egalitarianism, for, in this case, as we talked about, rooting out particular behaviors, for helping people achieve purpose, right? So I think the book, in our discussion, you know, confirms and shows the extent in which our bureaucracy is as good as humans create it, right? So trying to understand whether, how, and when it's working in a particular way, I think is the task that organizational analysis is all about.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Finally, we would like to thank some wonderful people for supporting the show. Sarah Audner, Leon Prieto, Hadi Shaheen, Marshall Reiner, Alice Barbosa, Thomas Roulet, Heiko Schmidt, Barton Friedland, Guldem Kara Mustafa, Roberta Bernardi, Marina Timmer, Bernard Hogan, Eddie Hunsinger, Fiona Knight, Peaks Craft, Timothy Paul, Willy Leidon-Wirte, Gabriel Van Bunnen, and Clara Lux. It's easy to support the show, and all you have to do is go to our website, where a donations button will greet you. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.